It was just there. You have to understand that I did remember the craft. It just apparently never occurred to my young mind that I was flying. That evening at Marianne's house, I had the chance to go over all this again. I had a true feeling of discovery, achievement, and belonging. I felt good. I felt validated. The next day at Bud's, we immediately used the regression therapy to get into the alien gift scenario. And thanks to the hypnosis, I got into an area where I had previously gone blank. All of the business up to the dark room was the same. Then, instead of losing consciousness, or feeling that I had, I lingered in that dark room for quite some time until I heard a voice in my head. This voice, followed by other voices, lectured me. The gist was that they wanted me to take more responsibility when I spoke of them and my interactions with them to other humans. In other words, this was a duty, bearing the message of what I learned to others. I understood, but I didn't like the tone or method, and I guess I was being a little stubborn. They left me in pitch black. Stay here and think it over. They wanted to ensure that I would tell my story accurately, not adding anything of my own, just what I remembered. In retrospect, standing there in the gloom, this didn't seem unreasonable. I suppose I reacted in that way because of my natural stubbornness and resistance, which had given them such a hard time before, and in turn helped me maintain my memory. I told the rest of the story. Bud shook his head. He didn't see that regression was really useful with me. I wasn't coming up with that much more. I remembered almost everything consciously. Down the road, I might want to retrieve a lost memory with it, but for the time being it didn't seem that useful. My conscious memory aligned pretty well with my unconscious recollection. Bud gave me his thoughts on the matter. Let's go back to the beginning. First of all, they gave you a gift. When they left you alone in another room, you felt you were being chewed out or lectured. I would have to call this a good cop, bad cop scenario. Secondly, Bud said he felt the reason the aliens had me look in the mirror was to make me believe that I was also one of them. I was surprised to hear that. Why? I asked. He thought this way I would feel more a part of them and be less reluctant to take on the duties they were bestowing upon me. He seemed to have great insight, and I gained a great deal from it as we spent a little more time going over his investigations and theories. Later that evening, Marianne and friends dined with Bud. When she returned, she told me that Bud said that in all the years he had worked with abductees, I was the individual with the most conscious recall. At first that had seemed a curse. Now, it was becoming more, I hoped anyway, a blessing. 152, 153, human or alien? In December of 1994, after a stretch of peace, I was pulled again. I lay flat on my back with the effects of acceleration still buzzing around my head. I had the sense of a large echoey space, and sure enough, this was not the normal room in which I usually found myself. I was on a hard table. I pried myself up and, although I could move, it was slow. My eyesight was blurry and my peripheral vision limited, but I could pretty much tell where I was, as I pulled myself to a sitting position, legs dangling off the edge. I was in a huge rectangular room, perhaps half the size of a football field. The walls seemed to be corrugated metal. In fact, it looked as though I were in the interior of a jet hangar. As my eyesight cleared and I looked around, I saw something I didn't like much: human military guards. They were lined up, backs against the wall, spaced out at 20-foot intervals. Outside, I heard the roar and scream of jets taking off and landing. I looked around. On the other side of my table was a rectangular platform, 20 feet by 15 feet, surrounded by tiers of steps. On this platform stood two barrel-shaped transparent containers, glass or even some sort of magnetic field, perhaps. These were maybe 15 feet in circumference, about 8 high. Each case held one male and one female human. The female had a certain resemblance to Teresa, but I wasn't sure. Two men in lab coats appeared, walking with an alien. Humans fraternizing with aliens on an equal basis was pretty upsetting to me, of course, but I had to remind myself that I'd seen humans before who had been the result of screen imaging, aliens messing with my brain. Nonetheless, The longer I watched, the more I had the sense that these really were humans. I also seemed to sense that these containers were some sort of transport system, and that they were man-made. But if this indeed were a human facility, why was the alien here? Why was I here? Had I been transported here using one of these things? Was the US military in league with my alien abductors? One of the men had some kind of metal rod or wand. The three turned their attention to the woman in the chamber who 155, Chapter 19, Human or Alien? I believe that the aliens are embarked on hybridization experiments, I told the group. Semen and eggs are extracted from us and, by utilizing alien DNA and biology, new beings are created. I think the worker aliens are a product, and may even be a commodity they trade in some sort of galactic business. But there's more to the alien agenda, and much that I've observed and theorized jives with what I heard from Bud Hopkins and other analysts I spoke to in Massachusetts. The Florida Alien Abduction Support Group listened carefully as I reported my new experiences, and the news from my visit north. The group was growing, its membership gaining not marginalized folk, but solid, everyday, upper middle class citizens, Democrats, Republicans, bankers, lawyers, a cross-section of the community. Also, these people weren't just locals. Some had traveled several hundred miles, and apparently because it had been announced that I was speaking. I seemed to be gaining notoriety. Again, as I remember the woeful isolation I'd felt all those years, I could see a reason for it now. I not only could help others with their experiences, but it was also helping me. So, I agreed to let Tim schedule a few speaking engagements for me, hoping, as I do now, that I could help people. I also tried to do as the aliens requested, be as accurate as possible in my reporting. It was as though they approved of my spreading the word of their activities to those who would listen and be open to what was happening. 154. The keepers were still too blurry for me to identify. He started prodding her. A tremendous sense of outrage filled me. I felt I had to stop them from doing whatever they were doing because it was abusive. As though in slow motion I struggled off the table and wobbled up the steps. They didn't hear me coming or expect me, so I was, human or alien. I'll handle this. He said right out loud, without telepathy in good old brusque, American English. He touched my hand with the rod, and ouch. Did that sting? I yanked my hand away from the woman. But I was still out of my head with anger. I tried to pull away again, but again that rod flicked down with unbearable pain. I staggered back, and things got very fuzzy. Then I was on the table again, with the impression that time had passed. The canisters on the transport platform were empty. I could see this as my head was tilted in that direction. I looked up. Hovering over me was a figure, examining me in some manner. And this figure kept changing back and forth between alien and human. I felt quite drugged. Usually during these abductions I'm wide awake. This time I was filled with fogginess with only intervals of clarity. The human, alien was lecturing me in a fatherly fashion. I could comprehend everything he was saying, yet my mental state was such that I couldn't retain the information. The sound of jet planes kicked up again. The man, alien left me. The jet activity stopped, and dead silence descended. Then there was a rolling sound of a giant hangar door opening. I looked up and sure enough, this door was slowly moving, revealing a night sky. I could see lights and runways, and past them the dim forms of a starlit desert. The smells and feels of cool desert night air rolled in, and I could smell the sage and the cactus. I recognized the sight and feelings, and it felt like Nevada. There was every sign that I was in the southern Nevada desert. I used to vacation in Las Vegas several times a year, and I would always take trips out to enjoy the unique air and sensations of the Nevada desert. That was what I experienced now. Out on the desert landscape, I noticed, on the horizon to my left, a bright stationary light, just hanging in the sky, a spacecraft. It did not make a sound, but just hung there as though waiting for me. I sensed it was time to go, and not through the transport cylinders either. Realizing this, I felt relieved. Then, almost from nowhere, A man walked up to me. He leaned over the top right side of my head and began to 157, figure 27, the barrel-shaped containers of humans, able to dart between them and grab the arm of the woman, who I could tell by this time wasn't my wife Teresa at all. I pulled hard, and the zombie-like woman didn't budge. The alien stepped back. The images of the men in lab coats wavered and they became aliens as well. But this seemed to me to be just a ruse to confuse or frighten me, and I was far too angry to be put off from my mission. I heard the pounding feet of the guards by the wall, coming forward. Another rippling and the alien images faded. Again I was with a woman, an alien, and men in lab coats. The man with the rod motioned to the guards and they stopped in their tracks. 156F, the keepers, speak, telling me to read a book. He said it was the Roman by Mika Toimi Waldari and that it would aid my understanding. Then the whirls and whirs of acceleration began. I returned home remembering only this much and no more. More startling though was the fact that I had many cuts on my hand where the man had hit me with that wicked stinging rod. Any wounds I'd ever received on alien abductions before usually healed amazingly quickly, the process almost finished at the end of an encounter. These wounds were quite fresh, and didn't look anywhere near healed. They weren't deep, but they were quite painful. I didn't resent them though, they confirmed the reality to me of what had just happened. At the next UFO meeting, my friend Don, the law enforcement guy, noticed the cuts, healing but quite red and obvious. Will gotten close, and it felt good that he trusted me. Because he didn't want it to be known to the community at large that he was a UFO abductee. I told him the story, and what bothered us most were the implications of collusion of the US military with this whole business. Government officials have routinely denied any knowledge of UFO or alien activities, all the way back to the late 40s in Roswell. Don just suggested that I not read too much into anything, but just roll with it, and let it play out. I hadn't mentioned the book I'd been told to read. I didn't even know if it really existed, and I was afraid to go to the library to look for it. Maybe I was afraid it was an illusion, that it would show that I'd been fantasizing all this, that my cuts were some sort of strange stigmata. Maybe, though, I was even more afraid that the book might actually exist. Finally, my curiosity got the best of me. Almost 3 weeks later I was staring at a library computer monitor, typing in the title of that book and the name of its author. Sure enough, it popped right up on the screen, and there was a copy available. I was so shocked that I even started to faint. I grabbed onto the monitor and held on, as though to my sanity. When I recovered I did manage to check the book out and 158, take it home, eager to see exactly what this book was about. The book was a 600-page ancient autobiography of a man who held tremendous power about 2,000 years ago in Rome. Remember the bloodline business I spoke of before? I was convinced that I am descended from this man who claimed to get his knowledge and advice from godlike creatures whose dwelling was the stars. It seemed pretty obvious to me that I had some sort of tracking gene, something that came down the ages in my family, that the aliens could follow, manipulate and work with. Even though this book helped me understand a good deal, I was still pretty unsettled with the business that took place in that hangar. But what could I do? Journey to Washington, D.C., pound on doors, and demand to know what exactly was going on? I would just have to wait. Later, though, I got my answer. 159, DIMONDINTHE Sky, Chapter 20, Diamond in the Sky. I continued my work, sharing and helping others, continuing to spread the word. After the hangar experience though, I started seeing things in a different light, particularly when I heard reports on UFOs and government reaction. I continued to give talks to small groups from time to time. I attended various UFO group meetings, including the Tampa Project Awareness Conference, where I had the good fortune to meet Linda Moulton Howe. I was also invited to do a few radio talk shows, including the Mutual UFO Network, the Kathy Fountain Show in Tampa and the Brad Collins Show on Wink 1200 AM in Fort Myers. Initially, this widespread exposure made me nervous. I guess I really wasn't that comfortable with the idea of coming forward publicly with weird stories and open myself up for ridicule. But then when I considered the things that I had experienced in the last years, I figured I could handle radio. I kept my story simple and down to earth, no pun intended. After the first few shows, I was surprised to find that the public at large was more receptive than I had anticipated. In fact, I was astonished when the calls came in. Many shared abduction experiences. Many respectfully just wanted more information. I was also amazed at all the UFO sightings. It was now March 1995, and I had not been abducted lately. I was feeling pretty good, so I decided to attend the annual Shrimp Festival at Fort Myers Beach. 160. The county fair-like festivities take place on the beach just a mile from my home. It was late morning as I walked there, a clear and beautiful day, without a cloud in the sky. I had such a good time eating and drinking and watching the people and the parades, that time whisked by, and before I knew it I had less than a half hour before sunset. I wanted to be home before dark, so I started to walk down the beach to a more isolated area. That day though, a young man and woman were wading in the water, waiting to watch one of our gorgeous sunsets. As I approached them, a strange thing happened. My heart began to beat hard and adrenaline began filling me. "Not here," I whispered, thinking I was about to be abducted again. "Not now," an extremely loud voice inside me said, "watch us enter the atmosphere." So strong was this voice that my entire body vibrated and swayed uncontrollably to every word. I attracted the attention of the woman, and I managed to get a hold of myself. "You're about to see something fantastic," I said. "I know," said the woman. "The sunsets here are beautiful." I felt sheepish. Why had I said that? But then as I turned to hurry away, the woman cried out, "Oh my God! Is that a UFO?" I turned, and for some reason I knew exactly where to look. Right there, hanging stationary in the sky in broad daylight, was a diamond-shaped ship. It looked as though the sky had partially opened up to let it in, because directly behind the ship was a streak of bright white light with a hue of blue. It was beautiful, just hanging there. We stared at the magnificent thing. "Remember what you are seeing here today," I said. "There are people who spend an entire lifetime investigating these things and never see one." Then, in a flash, it disappeared. "It's not gone yet," I said to the woman. "Keep watching. It will come back." 161. The Keepers. DIMONDINTHE Sky. I stayed a moment and made conversation with her. This was an exciting moment, but frightening as well. It was exciting because I'd just shared a UFO experience in broad daylight, straight out of everyday reality, with immediate feedback from others. It was frightening, because this was a new way they had contacted me, and I was always frightened when they reached that deeply into my life. I asked the girl a favor. When she got back home, could she please write to me and tell me exactly what her experience was here, in her own words? She didn't feel that she could. She didn't feel that she could tell anyone about this, that people would think she was nuts back in her small town in Minnesota. I asked again, and gave her my address. I didn't tell her I had decided that I should start writing the book you're reading now. Alas, I never heard from her. I had the feeling, though, that I would hear from the aliens again, and soon. A few days later, late on the evening of March 23rd, I awoke suddenly, intensely feeling their presence, yet it was different than before. "We are almost there." It got to me, this different feeling. I was used to acceleration now, but not this. I became very frightened, and the energy was so intense that I curled up into the corner of the sofa in a fetal position and said aloud, "I'm too scared. I can't do this. Go away. Just go away, please." I was almost wailing in fear. "Why do you bastards insist on creeping up on people in the middle of the night? I'm not ready yet." The energy level radically dropped. I felt tremendous relief. I couldn't believe it. They had actually honored my request. This was all very strange. It made me wonder if I were now dealing with a different crew of aliens entirely. I could feel their presence fade and disappear. The next day I was invited back to the Brad Collins show. I almost didn't accept, because the topic was the US government's involvement in the UFO phenomenon. Collins felt that 163, figure, 28, watching the UFO on the beach, how do you know that? I hesitated for a moment, and then said, I seem to have some sort of connection with these things. Sure enough, it came back and performed quite a splendid show. When it was over, the guy started to jump up and down, yelling Yahoo, Yahoo. Then he ran away down the beach. The woman just shook her head. No one will ever believe that we really saw a UFO, she said. 162. The keeper's involvement was heavy. I wasn't so sure. But still, it was a chance to communicate again and maybe even learn, so I accepted. On the morning of the show, which was scheduled for 6 p.m., I had to run down the road a long way to get a part for my pickup truck. Since moving back to the Fort Myers Beach area, I had managed to settle down enough to acquire two beautiful and large dogs. One is a black lab and the other is a blonde golden retriever. They love to ride in the bed of the pickup. On the 60-mile trip that morning, they rode along, as usual. On the way back I was preoccupied, thinking about that evening's radio show. What was I going to say? I was in a pretty desolate area of highway, headed for the Gulf of Mexico, deep in thought when a telepathic voice in my head proclaimed loudly, "Just say what you know." In the back, my dogs began to whimper with fear. "That's it," I said, and it suddenly all seemed very clear. "Did you think you were in this alone? If I didn't know better, I would have sworn these guys had a sense of humor." But I didn't have long to laugh before a huge diamond-shaped spacecraft appeared in the sky in front of me. Yanking myself out of shock, I looked at the clock. 11:10 a.m. I looked back and yes, it was the same vessel I'd seen on the beach, just closer. Now I could judge it as maybe being 100 feet in length and about 50 feet wide. My truck rolled to a stop. It took me a while to realize that I'd stopped right in the middle of the road, not a good place. Still, there was no sign of traffic. There's always some kind of traffic hereabouts, but that day there were no cars or people either. The dogs behind me continued whimpering. The craft began to move away. I hurried to get closer, but it eluded me, finally dropping right into the Gulf of Mexico without a splash, confirming to me its interdimensional qualities. Diamond in the sky, figure 29, driving along the coast, spotting the UFO, I raced down a side road to check it out, getting to the place where it had disappeared in the water. I got as close as possible and then I stopped. The clock read, 11:42 a.m. Bullshit, I thought. It had been no more than 3 minutes since the craft had appeared, not 32 minutes. The dogs had stopped whimpering. I tried to look around a bit longer, but I finally had to accept that the ship was long gone. 164, 165, the keepers. When I got home, I called Don. Jim, you lost time. Do you think you were abducted? I wasn't sure. Everything about their behavior this past week has been different. After chewing this over with Don, I felt better. Eventually all would be revealed. Was I dealing now with a different set of aliens, creatures with a different methodology? It was hard to say, but then everything about this whole business is tough to deal with. That evening the radio show went without a hitch, and I was pleased with the way it turned out. Whenever I was asked or pressured about the US government's involvement, I didn't speculate, I just said, if pressed, that's possible, but I don't know for sure. This technique seemed to ease the host, and at the same time it afforded me the opportunity to share my experiences as fact instead of speculation, which gave balance to the show. In our UFO discussion group meetings, we often discuss the possibility that there are indeed different alien species involved in this whole interaction with humans, a kind of coalition. I began believing this because of the different descriptions and behavior patterns described by other abductees. I had a new attitude to all this by then, though. Before, I wanted the aliens out of my life. Now, it was as though I couldn't wait to see what was next. What was next was an acceleration in the evening, a low-pitched whirling sound, then, waking up. Only this time it didn't speed up as fast or get loud. The gut-wrenching part was still there, but not as strong, and it took longer than usual for me to black out. When I awoke, it was earlier than usual and I could see where I was going. I was high above ground, descending slowly into an abandoned carnival park. I was floating over a large old-fashioned diamond in the sky, figure 30, circle of beings in the carnival park, neglected wooden roller coaster. I also saw a few empty concession and gaming booths, shabby and falling apart. It was night, but I wasn't frightened for some reason. In fact, I was so calm and relaxed that I was enjoying the ride. 20 feet from the ground, I started to rock slowly back and forth several times like a pendulum, almost as if I were being guided to a target, and this was the final adjustment. The transport method was the same, but the technology was notably much more gentle. When I was a few feet from the ground, I saw the profiles of about a dozen large creatures standing in a semicircle, and then I blacked out. We would have given IT to you, but we knew IT wouldn't have meant anything unless you earned IT. IT was the only way you could possibly understand what you have been a part of and what you have to do. 167, 166, the Keepers, Diamond in the Sky. The message came to me loud and clear as I began to regain consciousness and opened my eyes. I later understood that by IT the voice meant knowledge. I found myself standing in that abandoned carnival yard, clear-headed and fully conscious. There were those creatures again, and I could see that holograms of human faces were cast over their faces, to disguise their true appearance and make me feel less apprehensive. I noticed that each alien seemed to be concentrating and communicating or transmitting its thoughts to the creature to my left. They seemed to be of like mind, as though combining their consciousness into one telepathic voice. They continued, "There are some things you need to understand. Yes, IT is true that we have been in contact with your government and heads of power. IT is also true that agreements have been made and kept secret from your people. IT is also true that in the past some of your people have lost their lives or have been badly hurt to protect this secret. Our hands had no part in this. We contacted your leaders because your planet is in grave trouble. Your leaders said the vast majority of your population wasn't ready for anything like US yet, so we made time agreements with your leaders as to when your people would be made aware of our presence. This part of the agreement has not at all been kept. IT was also agreed that in the meantime steps would be taken to correct the environmental condition of your planet with our advice and technology. We say advice because 168, we respect the fact that this is your planet, not ours. They also broke this agreement. I felt an awful wave of emotion from them, the feeling of abandonment. To feel any emotion from them at all was amazing. But this was quite overwhelming. You aren't giving up on us, are you? I asked. There was a long silent pause and I received the transmitted feeling of tremendous loss. Well, are you? I asked. No. I felt an immediate sense of relief, straight from my own emotions. Your air, your water, are contaminated. Your forests, jungles, trees and plant life are dying. There are several breaks in your food chain. You have an overwhelming amount of nuclear and biological weapons, which include nuclear and biological contamination. Your planet is overpopulated. Warning. IT is almost the point of being too late, unless your people act. There are better ways of deriving energy and food needs without causing your planet any damage. Those in power are aware of this and have the capability of putting these methods into worldwide use. I let this digest for a moment. I definitely had the feeling that these creatures were speaking as one. 169. The Keepers. Then I asked, why aren't we doing that now? Silence. I was willing to wait. I had come a long way to be treated like this by them, to have this kind of meeting. Apparently I had earned their respect and trust. The best part was that I was getting direct, truthful answers to my questions. I decided that I would milk this rare situation to its fullest, asking as many questions as I could get away with, even personal questions. I repeated my question, and they answered. Those in power view IT as a military and security threat. That upset me. You mean to tell me the people in power have the ability to save and better this planet, and they aren't doing it? Amnesty.